Let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11. Following up from yesterday's class and actually starting over. So that hopefully we'll have a one tape message. Ha ha. The doctrine of patriotism, or the believer's national faithfulness. The believer's national faithfulness. So in other words, this is going to be the study of patriotism from the standpoint of the believer. A believer's national faithfulness. Not patriotism in and of itself. Not patriotism in its pure form. Not even patriotism in its ideal form. Patriotism from the standpoint of the believer. And therefore, what we call it is a believer's national faithfulness. Point number one, we must recognize, first of all, the bona fide existence of nationalism. Two major passages, the institution of nationalism in Genesis 11, verses 7 through 9. The so-called Tower of Babel incident. The Godhead communes among itself and says, "Let us go down there and confuse their languages, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now that is the incident. That is the occurrence of it. You have no explanation of it other than from a religious or spiritual standpoint. Because of the religious force of this group of people and the potential for enslaving the volition of others into a particular religious way of life, God decided in the progress of his plan to, at this time, disperse the people of the earth into separate, independent, and totally different societies. They would be distinguished primarily by language, and I believe personally that he also made racial changes at this point. There's no way to prove it, but as far as trying to find a spot for it, I suggest that when he changed the languages supernaturally, he also changed the racial features supernaturally into specific dominant races, and they were all separate from one another. They didn't look like one another anymore. They couldn't understand each other anymore. And this was to prevent a religious monopoly, if you please, a religious hierarchy that would then prevent or frustrate the advances of truth. The political, or rather nationalistic explanation of this is found at Acts 20, or rather 17, Acts 17, verses 26 and 27. And he, Paul says, referring to God, made from one group of people every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. There's the divine decrees associated with nationalism. God has in his plan the progress and the future of all nations. Having determined their appointed times, how long they're going to be, and the boundaries of their habitation, how big they're going to get, their geographical extension. Verse 27, what is the purpose for nationalism? So that they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. There's the spiritual reason. See, if there is one nation monopolized by a particular political ideology or a religious event, then that is going to infringe upon the free will of others, and it will prevent the progress of truth, being that darkness is so powerful, given that God has allowed it to be so. And so he has actually decreed that there be individual societies or nations so that no one can actually dominate the whole world. And any attempt to do so, of course, is unauthorized. So we recognize that the existence of nations is bona fide, and they are to be kept separate as far as sovereignty goes, national sovereignty. They can interact with one another. They can have mutual trade agreements, mutual visitation rights. They can have cultural exchanges and so forth, except between the Russians and the United States. We don't need any cultural exchanges there. But this is all bona fide. That is, the separate, distinct existence of nations. Main point number two. The believer is on loan from the kingdom of heaven. The believer is on loan from the kingdom of heaven to represent truth in a world of darkness, from which Jesus is absent. Four subpoints. A, the transfer activity takes place at the moment of salvation, as is indicated at Colossians chapter 1, verse 12 and 13. It says, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. In light is the new position. It says, for he delivered us from the domain of darkness, transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. There's the transfer. So, on loan from the kingdom of heaven does not mean that we originated in heaven, but that our present citizenship is in heaven, and we are on loan from that citizenship to function here on earth. We never left the earth. We changed status, changed citizenship, and we are left here on loan. Point B, the new citizenship is stated in Philippians 3:20. Familiar too, it says, for our citizenship is in heaven. Point number C, the principle of representation of Christ, or ambassadorship, is taught at 2 Corinthians 5:20. 2 Corinthians 5:20, therefore we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were entreating through us, we beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. And the word on behalf of Christ is the idea of instead of Christ, in place of Christ, since he's not here to do it. It's true, it's also on behalf of him, but it's also a substitution type word. We are doing it in place of him, instead of him. The preposition is huper. And you can see here then a use of the preposition that we were looking at earlier in 1 Corinthians 15. It's interesting that that came up. But this is huper. Notice how they translate it, on behalf of. However, on behalf of is still a little bit less than what you want to say, because this is a substitution issue. Jesus is not here, right? The Bible teaches very clearly he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. He does not visit here anymore. His last visitation was accomplished in about 96 AD when he visited John. Further amplification of ambassadorship is brought out in Ephesians 5:8. Formerly darkness, now you're light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. There you have the idea of reflecting your new national status. Philippians 2:14 and 15. Another familiar passage, I trust, but we'll quickly look at it. Do all things without emotional complaining or intellectual complaining, so that you may become blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. There you have the contrast. On the one hand, you're children of God. That's your new citizenship. But you're in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Your responsibility is to shine as lights in the world. You also have Matthew 5:13 through 16, which talks about the salt principle and the light principle. We don't need to look at it, but you can write them down. Matthew 5:13 through 16, two principles, salt and light. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Salt of the earth, primary principle for salt is preservative. Also has the idea of bringing out the taste in something. So it's functioned in both ways. And it has applies to the believer. The believer, as he represents truth, becomes the preservative of society. The believer, as he properly represents light standards, also makes light standards attractive to others, or makes it palatable, makes it tasteful, so that others are attracted to it. Then it says you are the light of the world. Light of the world, as explained in Philippians 2, in this generation in which you shine as lights in the world. How? Holding fast the faithful word, holding fast the word of God. That's how we shine as light. So it's a matter of representing truth. Point D, our alien status is mentioned in addition to the Philippians 3:20 passage, which says our citizenship is in heaven. Is mentioned at 1 Peter 2:11 and 12. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Why are you an alien and a stranger? Because you are on earth that is saturated with darkness, and you are of the kingdom of light. You have a heavenly citizenship. Your true citizenship is of heaven. You're only living on the earth. You're only temporarily dwelling here. And your responsibility while you're here is to keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, instead they may give glory to God. In other words, they may recognize that you are a righteous individual, at least that they have no bona fide morality gripes against you. They may criticize your Christianity, but they have no moral gripes against you. There is the real issue in your testimony. Don't let the unbeliever have any moral gripes against you. If he has gripes against you, make sure it is because of your Christianity. Make sure it's because of your representation of truth. It's quite a burden. And sometimes that in itself is a big deterrent to sin. When you're talking about a public sin, something that's going to be possibly exposed. And it's a bona fide deterrent. One of the bona fide deterrents. Also back at chapter 1, verse 17, says, if you address as Father, the one who impartially judges according to each man's work, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay upon the earth. The time of your stay upon the earth indicates that this is just a temporary dwelling. Now, obviously, the unbeliever is also here only temporarily. But it is not viewed in his case from a temporary standpoint because he is of the world. He is going to maintain his citizenship in the cosmos, in the darkness kingdom, whether he is physically on the earth or not. We are not of an earthly citizenry anymore. We are of a heavenly citizenry. We are simply here on loan to represent truth to those upon the earth, and we will be taken off the earth at the right time in God's plan. So the believer is on loan from the kingdom of heaven to represent truth in a world of darkness, since Christ is not present. Point three. But God's plan has assigned to each believer a particular national location. God's plan has assigned to each believer a particular national location which comes under the doctrine of status quo. 1 Corinthians 7, 17 through 24. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each one, see, assigned and called, in this manner let him walk, and thus I direct in all the churches. Now there is the general principle. That is the general statement of assignment when you are called, when you are saved. And the doctrine of status quo, in this manner let him walk. Now Paul is going to develop this, and he's going to use several examples. One of the examples he does not use is nationalism. But that doesn't matter. The general principle is stated in verse 17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each one, in this manner let him walk. Verse 18 deals with cultural distinctions, and that's the closest it gets to a national distinction. Was any man called already circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? Let him not become circumcised. Now, the emphasis here is heritage, cultural heritage, not a religious concept. Sometimes that can be brought into it, but the primary application here is if you have a non-Jewish heritage, don't try and reverse it just because you become a Christian. If you have a Gentile heritage, don't try to reverse that just because you became a Christian. We, of course, will spend more time on this on Wednesday's class. Verse 20 repeats the principle. Oh, verse 19, he says circumcision is no count. It's nothing. What matters is obeying truth. Verse 20, let each man remain in that condition in which he was called. Were you called a slave? Another example. Don't worry about it, but if you are able to become free, well, fine, do that. In other words, the doctrine of status quo is not an absolute. The doctrine of status quo says, when you first become a Christian, maintain status quo until you see how things are going to go. See what happens. See how your growth progresses. See what you learn about God's word, God's intentions. Maybe it's not God's plan for you to stop being a slave. Maybe it's not God's plan for you to give up your national heritage. Maybe it's not God's plan for you to get married or to get divorced. So he uses that example. Verse 22 to explain the previous example. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price, do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called. Repetition. Third time, isn't it? He's emphasizing the doctrine of status quo. Next example, verse 24. Brethren, let each man remit. Whoops, I already read that. Verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no specific command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who, by the mercy of the Lord, is trustworthy. I think then that it is good in view of the present distress that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. Don't seek a divorce. Are you released from a wife? Don't seek a wife. Again, doctrine of status quo. Third application. Don't be so quick to get married. Oh, I'm a Christian. Now I got to settle down, find a wife, raise some kids. No. Wait. Take your time. Grow up spiritually. What if you're married? You become a Christian. Oh, now I got to start all over. Get rid of the wife. Get rid of the kids. Start all brand new. No, that's an extreme too. Maintain status quo. Wait till you get some guidance from the Lord. And see, the new believer is not going to be able to pick up immediately on what Paul wrote earlier about an unbeliever becoming a believer within a marriage. And now his wife, using the man as an example, his wife's an unbeliever. See, a brand new Christian is not going to have that perspective immediately. Brand new Christian is all of a sudden going to realize, well, I'm a Christian now. Gee, I have nothing in common with my wife. What am I going to do? And if he doesn't love her, all he needs is some excuse. You'd be surprised how many marriages exist without love between the husband and the wife. If he does love her, then he's not going to be too concerned about it. But as soon as he hears the doctrine of separation, then he's going, oh, what am I going to do now? That's why the doctrine of status quo is one of the very important things you need to teach a new believer, which I haven't emphasized before, but teach the doctrine of status quo. Now, you've just become a Christian, but don't go making any drastic changes in your life. Just get through. Get to Bible class and start getting through. So the doctrine of status quo is part of this issue of your national location. Point four. Therefore, faithfulness to the assigned leaders of your nation is required of believers. Notice the term assigned leaders. This is not assigned from the standpoint of the political system within your nation. It is assigned from God. God is the one who determines who's going to be the leader of the nation, not any election. Does that mean we don't vote? No, that doesn't mean you don't vote. It's part of your responsibility. But you must recognize that God allows, not makes, but allows elections to go a certain way. It's not out of his control. If election turns out what we would say bad, that means God allowed it to turn out that way for some reason. And we know there are a lot of bad leaders out there in some nations. A few bad leaders in our nation, in the Senate, in the House, any liberal, is a bad leader. The way it is. But God allowed them to be elected. Alright, therefore faithfulness to the assigned leaders of your nation is required of believers. 1 Peter 2, 13 through 15. We can go through these references quickly. They are familiar to you. A little repetition will not ever hurt. Why? Because eventually you need to have these things so in your frame of reference that you think truth. You think doctrine. I talked earlier about having a frame of reference, the frame of reference of Paul, the frame of reference of Peter, the frame of reference of John. This frame of reference is such that you have it in your soul. So that if someone were to say, well, what's the Bible have to say about support of your national leaders? And you can just rot off the top of your tongue. 1 Peter chapter 2, Titus chapter 2, Romans chapter 13. And you just, that's what repetition is for. Not only to teach you principles, but also to teach you so that you can learn the passages. All right, 1 Peter 2, 13 through 15. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Example, king, verse 14, governor, who is sent by the king for the punishment of evildoers. And in the context of Rome, see, you have the king, Caesar, and he sent governors to rule over the various provinces, and this governor was authorized to take care of punishments and administration of justice. Verse 15, for such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Once again, moral integrity, moral consistency. Alright, the second reference is Titus 3, I said 2. But hey, if you're that close, you're going to look at Titus 2 and say, well, that's not it. It must be chapter 3. If you don't find it in chapter 3, it must be chapter 1. If you don't find it there, oh, it must not be Titus. Point is, you need to know. Titus chapter 3, verse 1. Remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed. Ready. ready for every good deed emphasizes moral consistency in the context. Because it is the obedience to the laws of the land, obedience to the authorities of the land. Both these passages I just gave are general. The Romans 13 passage is a little more specific. It states it from a general standpoint, but then it also gives some examples, specific examples. Romans 13, 1 through 7. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Here's the spiritual insight into the political arena. For there is no authority except from God. And those which exist are established by God. There's the divine viewpoint of national leaders and international leaders. It is all permitted by God. What about the push for one world government? It's all permitted by God. We are not to be concerned, oh, they're getting closer to a one world government. Europe is getting closer. We've got to try and prevent it. We've got to do this. We've got to. No. Let the course of this world's events take place. Let them move along according to God's timetable. You ride along with it. And you simply recognize the progress toward fulfillment of prophecy. You do not take activist-type steps to intervene, whether it is internationally or whether it is nationally. Doesn't mean you cannot campaign for a candidate. But what believer genuinely has time to actively campaign for a candidate? You give him your support if you choose to. You give him your vote by all means. But your responsibility here on earth, every believer, not just some, one believer might say, well, your job, you think that you were called to do this. I was called to make sure the political system of our country gets straightened out. You can say, wrong. You were not called for that purpose. Show me in our instruction manual where it covers that point. And then I will support you. But if you cannot find it in your instruction manual, then I guess you better support what the instruction manual does say. No political activism. No social activism whatsoever. And we'll get to that maybe. Okay, so we have Romans 13, 1. The true perspective here is to recognize that no authority exists except through God, and it is established by God, or it is, and we understand, the permissive will of God in that context. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. There you go. If it's a bad authority, tough. Don't resist it. With one exception, right? If that authority tries to prevent you from fulfilling your spiritual responsibility, then you resist it to the hilt, even if it's to the point of death. But just because this person wants to raise taxes, 50%, tough. You have to do. Who's in charge? God's allowing it. God knew it was going to happen. This is just moral oppression. You think that would be bad? Try living in a communist land. You think 50% taxation would be bad? Try living where they have no running water. Try living where they have no roads and highways. We could live with 50% taxation. We really could. Anyway. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. You're in rebellion against God. They who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. See, we are not a citizen of this world. We're only a representative from another country in this world, the country of heaven. And as such, we are to partake from a moral standpoint of this society. And we are to follow the, you know, the moral standards. We are to be responsible citizens, therefore vote by all means. But we are not to become actively involved in the sense of trying to overthrow something, other than through verbalization. If you want to say, hey, such and such a president doesn't represent truth, doesn't represent moral stability, then say so. Write it if you want to. And realize you may get censored and you may get prosecuted for it, depending on the type of government that you are attacking or that you're under. But leave it at that. Don't get out on the streets. Don't put your bodies in front of tanks. And don't put your bodies in front of policemen's clubs. Just stay out of the arena, unless it is the spiritual arena, and then be in the middle of it. Because if you do, if you get out there and you actively oppose a government, actively walk in front of the White House saying, down with the Bush, down with the Bush, set a match to it. You are rebelling against God. God says, accept the authority that is over you. Now, if you have an opportunity to vote him out, vote him out if you want to. Vote somebody else in, fine. That's your mandate. But political activism is rebelling against God. Social activism to try and change the laws of this land. This land advocates abortion. It is immoral. Whether a person thinks it's murder or not is not an issue. For the sake of the argument, let us say that it is murder. And the government has authorized that murder. Speak out against it. But don't get politically active. Don't become an activist. Your responsibility is to promote truth, to teach truth, primarily the issue of salvation and Christian way of life growth. You can address moral issues. You can stand up and say, hey, we shouldn't have adultery. We shouldn't have houses of ill repute. We shouldn't have drugs all over the land. We shouldn't have this. You can talk against it and not be out of line. Just don't become politically active, because when you become politically an activist, then you are rebelling against the authorities of the land. Yeah, but shouldn't we try to change it? No, let the unbelievers do their part in advancing the cosmos system. Let them do what they want to do. God's in control. God's pulling the strings. You're along for the ride. Believers don't understand that. But you are along for the ride in whatever nation you're in. We're blessed. We have a fantastic place here. I would probably be condemned by believers if I taught this under a communist country, but I would have to teach it under a communist country. The Bible wouldn't change. I'm wandering, so I don't think we're going to get time to see the examples, but what Paul was under a communist-type regime. Sure, you have the great free enterprise system of Rome, but you also have a lot of oppression in Rome. A lot of persecution, depending on what Caesar was in. How did he handle it? He honored the authorities of Rome. How did Jesus handle the authorities of Rome? Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. How did how about the religious authorities of the land? You know, they are the same thing. When you have, depending on your culture, if you have a religious authority that also functions as a political authority, how did you handle that? Well, they represented spiritual truth, and they went up against the religious authority. But when Paul was in front of a council of Jewish elders and priests, and he was being called on the carpet for his representation of truth, and one of these men hit him, and he started saying, you hypocrite, you whitewashed wall, you this, you that, who do you think you are hitting me? Someone said, you talk that way against the high priest? Apparently he was in disguise. Maybe he didn't have time to get dressed. It was in the morning. And the political Roman rulers had told the Jews to call the council. So maybe he hadn't had a chance to get dressed. Paul didn't know it was the high priest. When he found it, he said, I'm sorry, man. It is said, you shall not judge, you shall not curse, you shall not speak against the rulers of your land. If I had known it, I wouldn't have spoken that way. That was his attitude. You don't judge a person, you don't curse the person, you represent truth. And he was doing that. Okay. Point number 5. Oh, one other reference under point 4, Proverbs 24:21. My son, fear Jehovah and the king. Do not associate with those who are given to revolution. Change is revolution. Main point number 5. Our alien responsibility. Our alien responsibility. See, I should have entitled this "The Believer's National Faithfulness," or "The Aliens Are Already Here." Our alien responsibility is illustrated by believers of Israel in captivity to Babylon. Anymore. Got plenty of time. I mean room. Our alien responsibility is illustrated by believers of Israel in captivity to Babylon. Jeremiah 29:1-14. Israel in captivity, specifically believers in captivity, actually become a representative of the church in a foreign captive land. Being in the darkness system, we are in captive. We are captive in darkness. We are free, but we are still captive in the darkness system. Jeremiah 29:1-14. Now these are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the rest of the elders of the exile, the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Now the message is addressed to all the people, but it's really only going to be pertinent to the believer. He's the only one who's going to respond to the message of the prophet. This was after King Jeconiah and the queen mother, the court officials, the princes of Judah and Jerusalem, the craftsmen, and the smiths had departed from Jerusalem. The letter was sent by hand of Elisha, the son of Shaphan, to these guys. Let's get on with the subject here. Verse 4. Thus the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I send in exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses, live in them, plant gardens, eat their produce, take wives, become the fathers of sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands that they may bear sons and daughters and multiply there, and do not decrease. And seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to Jehovah on its behalf, for in its welfare you have welfare. That's how you view your national status. Therefore, if you are in an oppressive society like a communist nation, you are still to seek the benefit of that city. You are to pray for it. How are you to seek the benefit of it? Prayer. And if you have the opportunity, speak out against oppression. Realizing that when you speak out against oppression with a spiritual emphasis, then you may come under persecution and may even be imprisoned or killed. Verse 8, for thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, do not let your prophets who are in your midst and your diviners deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams which they dream, for they prophesy falsely to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord. For thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill my good word to you and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Now, although this is a physical thing with regard to the nation of Israel, you can see the application to us from the standpoint of our attitude. We are here in a captive nation. God has plans for us, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give us a future and a hope. And so we rest in that. In the meantime, we obey the laws of the land, as long as they do not infringe upon our spiritual rights. And spiritual rights are not the same thing as moral rights, no matter what the oppression. What about racial oppression? I was talking to a believer the other day about this. What should I do? You know? You get on the bus, if they even let you on the bus, you had to go to the back. If you were black in the South. You had to go to the back of the bus. I don't want to go to the back of the bus, so I'm not going to ride the bus. I'm going to walk instead. Wow. That made a real impact. Well, you know, they had separate drinking fountains. So what do we do? Out of rebellion. You say, I have a right to drink out of that drinking fountain. I'm going to go drink out of that drinking fountain. I just have a right to. I'm going to stand up for my rights. A believer, that in a situation where you know it is going to cause trouble, that is activism. And sure, your rights are all stepped on. Sure, you're being oppressed. But as a believer, that's not the issue. As a believer, the issue is truth and spiritual rights. And the fact that you can't drink out of that fountain, you've got to go across the park to drink out of another fountain, has nothing to do with your spiritual rights. Now, at the same time, you can speak out against it and say, I don't think this is right. And leave it at that. Of course, even speaking out against it might get you in trouble. But that's all right. You can speak out against immorality and represent your spiritual responsibility. Okay, main point number 6. However, National laws do not have priority over spiritual laws. National laws do not have priority over spiritual laws. We know that. We've studied it before. Two subpoints, very quickly. We don't even have to look at them. I'm not going to finish this, so I might as well stop hurrying. I mean, I've got, what am I on? 0.6, I've got 7, 8, 9, and 10, so forget it. Point A, a religious context. Religious context found in Acts 4, 13 through 20, and chapter 5, 26 through 29. It simply, without looking at it, when the Jews came to the apostles and said, stop going around teaching in this name Jesus. Why are you doing this? Didn't we give you instructions not to do it? And the answer was, we ought to obey God rather than men. And actually, you be the judge. Is it right to obey God or is it right to obey men? So you have those two passages. Acts 4, 13 through 20, chapter 5, 26 through 29. Point B, you have Daniel, the example of Daniel in chapter 6, 1 through 22. Remember that when the king made this decree that no one's going to pray, or that no one's going to worship any other one but Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel had been praying for, you know, months and months and months, three times a day. And these people who wanted to get him out of the political arena because he was exerting a great deal of influence realized that there's no way we're going to get anything against this guy unless it's in the area of his God, because he's morally impeccable. So we're going to have to do something about this religion of his. So they connived and they said, hey, Neb, you're so great, we ought to have everybody worshiping you and nobody else. Neb, in his vanity, said, sounds good to me. Wasn't even thinking of the consequences, and he respected Daniel greatly. But once he made the decree, that was it. Once the decree came down, then they quickly, you know, spied on Daniel, came in, hey, Nebuchadnezzar, somebody violating your decree. Oh, yeah, let's get him. Who is it? Daniel. Oh, what, Daniel? Uh-oh. But it was a decree that had to be taken place, carried out. So what was it? The lion's den? So Daniel was thrown in the lion. Supposed to be eaten up. It wasn't, because God delivered him. And Daniel came out in his testimony and said, I'm innocent toward you, king. I haven't done anything against you, see? This is proof of it. God delivered me from the lions. That's proof that I have been innocent toward you. I've maintained my spiritual integrity, but I have not violated moral standards. I've not violated your authority. I'm for you, Nebuchadnezzar. I'm on your side. Jeremiah told us to seek the benefit of our city and so forth. So those are two examples there where you do resist the national authority when that national authority is infringing upon your spiritual rights. The problem is believers today have a difficult time distinguishing between what is a spiritual right and what is simply a moral or human right. A human right is not a spiritual right. When your human rights are infringed, tough. Your spiritual rights are the ones you're supposed to insist upon. And if you're going to go out and get yourself killed for your human rights, you just violated your spiritual ambassadorship. Go out and get yourself killed for your spiritual rights. That's what God's going to defend you with. That's what God's going to honor. Wasting your time, getting thrown into prison because you're violating someone else's rights at an abortion clinic? That has nothing to do with spiritual rights, nothing to do with representation of Bible truth. All right, main point number 7 is where we're going to have to pick up some other time. When? I don't know. But it's simple. It's the teaching of Jesus. Point number 8 will be the example of Jesus. Point number 9 will be the example of Paul. And point number 10 is a summary. So you can see I couldn't quite finish it all today. I guess if I had started on time, I might have got a little bit further along, or if I had not amplified to the extent that I amplified, but as you know, the amplification of Bible truth by your pastor teacher is just as valuable and beneficial as the actual content of the message. So next time we'll be wherever we're going to be.